Dalton. Now, President, he kept on saying. President of the Board of Trade. Now, you'll have views about that. President knows everything, you know. President is omniscient. Come on, President, tell us what you think about the conduct of the war. Don't hesitate, President. We're all ears. Come on, President, you're holding back. President said, well, I don't know anything about it except going to vote my minister. Nonsense, President. We can talk on any subject. Everybody knows that. Look at a know-all. Go on. A lot of that went on. Well, he answered back with his very loud voice saying, no, no, Max. I'm not going to obey your orders. Come on, Max. We're just making fun of him. Oh, no. I'm not going to be made fun of. Come on. Come on, President. Well, a lot of rough chaff. Then Beaverbrook. Then, what's the name? Danton. Fulbright. And said, well, Beaverbrook, who is really responsible for Munich? And Beaverbrook said, everybody knows that. Halifax, Geoffrey Dawson, Sam Hoare, and the dead Chamberlain. Curious and brutal, he said. To which Fulbright said, what is the opposition, Lord Beaverbrook? Beaverbrook was an archipelago. Remember that film in which we serve and so on, copies of Daily Express on the water saying there'll be no war. He said, I'm a man of peace. I'm not a man of war. I prefer peace to war. I'm a man of peace. And there's a fine difference drawn between peace good, appeasement no good. He then said, I can tell you about the British. They're brave. They're very brave. They're wonderful people. They're the best people in the world. But they don't like me, and I don't like them. And they never will. Every penny I've dragged out of them, I've dragged out of them by the most appalling endeavours. Quite interesting that,
yes,
certainly. Then Fulbright said, well, what is your opinion of Lord Salisbury? Lord Cranborne, who was then maybe number two in the Ministry of Foreign Office by then.
Why would he ask that question?
Didn't he just ask about British States?
Yes.
Ah, he's a Cecil. They're the most wonderful family we have. They're wonderful people. They're noble, they're brave, they're distinguished. Everybody looks up to them. They wouldn't talk to people like you and me. We have to doff our caps to them. We have to bow low. They have no use, people like me. But the proudest possession of the British people, they're marvellous. With fury. They're the only aristocratic family ever made. They wouldn't speak to him. Beaverbrook is completely out. No kind of, yes, rapport at all. They wouldn't have, you see, the nearest he came to it was by, one of the Cecil daughters was the wife of a man called Campbell, Robin Campbell, who was a commander. And he used to ask commanders' wives and people like Annette and Bevan and Michael Foote to dinner. And she was a daughter of Ormsby Gore, was married to Cecil. And he thought via her he'd get into Cecil well, but it didn't work. And so the literary spoke with fury. What do you think of Mr. Law? He's a son, my greatest friend. Man I admired more than any other man in all my life. Bernard Law, you'll have heard of him. Wonderful man. Integrity itself. Wonderful man. My greatest friend. I was devoted to him. His son is just a traitor. That's all he is. He's a traitor. He's not a conservative at all. Nor am I. I've never joined the party. But he's a traitor. He's turned to the left. He's no good. And he'll fail. He loathed Dick Law because that's all he is, you see. He wasn't a good Canadian.
Now why is it that Alan Taylor loved Beaverbrook? So why did he awaken
well, why
love?
Did, and why did Michael Foote yeah. say he was my second father?
Yeah.
Alan Taylor liked any kind of anti-establishment figures. He liked rudeness. He was very, look, Beaverbrook's business was to get intellectuals, hire intellectuals of a lively kind and corrupt. He did that to Tom Dreiberg, who then turned on him, who renounced the life of him. He did it to Michael Foot, he did it to Taylor. He liked taking up left-wing low, the cartoonist, left-wing people, and then making them instruments of his will. Sometimes they failed, sometimes it worked. But he liked twisting them around as weapons against the horrible British establishment, which he deeply hated.
And deeply wanted to belong to.
Of course. Look, he belonged to, I'll tell you, his history is this. He, in about 1968,
comes out of New Brunswick.
Later. What? When he came to New Brunswick, there was a group of, as it were, young Turks who, you see, the anti-Victorian movement took two forms. One was Bloomsbury. Hated success, hated vulgarity. I mean, idealism of a certain kind. And extreme anti-establishment.
Yes.
And anti-religion. And anti-all that. As against success, conventionality, conformity, riches. The other was tough. People who said the world is my oyster. Against respectability. Yes. From their point of view. Rather like the Kaiser. The same period. They were Winston.
Yes.
And Lord Carson. And Duff Cooper, a little later. And Birkenhead.
Yes.
And Beaverbrook.
Yes.
They were tough adventurers who were prepared to defy the establishment and to wreak their own adventurous will
yes.
upon it.
Yes.
And fight their way upwards. And not do it by conventional flattery, amiability, tactfulness. You see? And that was a kind of cad's party. And that's what Beaverbrook found extremely congenial. And he was a very fresh cup of tea from Canada. He was rich, made a lot of money, he paid for them in part.
Yeah.
Paid Winston quite large sums
yeah.
over his life. And I dare say others too.
Yeah.
And they found him just exactly what they liked. What he was liked by my great friend James the Rothschild, another Berlin playing, semi-adventurous immigrant from France.
Yes.
I mean, the point was, he was full of temperament, he was jolly, he was prepared to defy conventions.
Yes.
He was what's called good company.
Yes.
But they were the boys.
Yes.
And they came to power with Lloyd George,
yes.
who was their creation as Prime Minister.
Yes.
You see, because Lloyd George was all right, because he was a cad too, in that sense. In a way, Roosevelt was not quite of that breed. He was also aristocratic, betrayed, but these are not the only aristocratic among these people was Winston himself,
yes.
who was different from the others. He kept his connections with ducal families, which he was descended.
Yes.
But nevertheless, what he liked was cigars, drink, racing, and obscenity.
Yeah.
You see? But that didn't go with polite Edwardian.
Yeah.
As were the King Edward VII was a bit like that, but they weren't friends of his.
Yeah.
Too young, I think.
Yeah.
Died in 1910. George V was exactly what they didn't like.
Yes. Now,
they slightly overlapped with the rich Jewish millionaires.
Mm-hmm.
All the same. You know, there's a famous Max Beerbohm cartoon, which I've never ceased to like. It's a Semitic cartoon, which is a cartoon of the gates of Buckingham Palace, outside which stand four men, four or five, in top hats with very long noses. And they are Sir Edward Stern, Sir Ernest Castle, Sir Otto Beit, Lord Rothschild, maybe, I don't know, so somebody else was able to. I think there was another Jewish millionaire of the same sort. And what they're saying to each other, 1910 is the date, there's a King Edward. What they're saying is, are we as welcome as before? Well, they weren't.
What other dealings?
It's a very funny cartoon.
Yes, it's good. What other dealings did you have with Beaverbrook after turning him down over the
Well, then standard? He took me back to London, took me to his office, the Lord Privy Seal. He said, I've got a sinecure, the British government. No duties, you know. wonderful thing, the British government. Pays your money doing nothing at all. If you're important, that's how I've lived. There's a lot of it. I mean, on that occasion, I got on technically quite well. I didn't insult him, and I was quite polite, and I was rather cowed. I didn't like him at all, but I was rather fascinated by this extraordinary spectacle.
Yeah. Did you see him subsequently in the 50s and 60s?
Never again, no. Because after refusing the job, he took against me. And he was very insulted. So in 1950 or so, I wrote... I was commissioned to a piece by the Observer, which they finally cancelled because they had some other piece with somebody else. And here I was with my piece on Anglo-American relations. And somebody at the BBC discovered about this and asked me if it could be broadcast. It's quite short. So I read it, and then it was printed in The Listener. It wasn't very interesting. It says England and America were married to each other. It might be an unhappy marriage. It might go through terrible, but there would never be a divorce. Yes. And even an article appeared in the Evening Standard 3 days later called Mr. Berlin, which the editor, the commission, ordered to write by Beaver Brook. And what it said was, it was an attack. It said, who is this Mr. Berlin? He's an unmarried bachelor of 40, 49 must be. That is why his thoughts, no doubt, constantly turned to marriage. That is a metaphor they used. He is pro-American, evidently. Nothing wrong with that, but he has nothing to do with the empire. What does a man like that know about his triumphs and his agonies?
Sort of.
Oh, yes?
Oh, that's very unpleasant stuff.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Then I went on this time. Not so much about me, but direct, straight at the Semitic attack. Well, it was. Nothing happened. I didn't respond. I met the editor afterwards. I said, well, I asked him why he'd written it. He said, well, you know, orders is orders. That's what the boss wanted. That's a man called, I think I'm quite well known of it, friend of Arthur Schlesinger. I've forgotten his name. Not a very nice man.
Okay. When you came back in 42, it was to consult. When you came back in 44, it was to consult.
Yes.
When did you leave Washington? What I want to get us to is Moscow. When did you leave? When did you conclude your business in Washington?
46.
46.
April.
April 46. When did the Moscow experience begin? I mean, can you tell me
September 45. Mm-hmm. Went on till January the 5th, 1946. Mm-hmm. The date I remember is I called Madame Akhmatova on that day in Leningrad, and microphones were conspicuously put in her ceiling. Mm-hmm. Day after. Ooh. She was under observation. Not in, as a spying measure, but as a et terrorem, as a frightener. I think of January 5. I left for Finland.
Can you tell me how the trip generated itself? We've got ahead of ourselves in the sense I have not reread your wonderful memoir on this subject, so I can't remember how it came about.
It doesn't describe it. Mm. So you can ask me. That came about because for two reasons, really. I made friends with the Russian officials in the State Department. Trip Boland, the famous, became an intimate friend. A man called Freddy Reinhardt was there, may not be alive. A man called Derbrow, the whole Russian section. I met them through John Russell, who had been in the British Embassy in Washington during the war, and who then came to be in Moscow, And the one that came to Washington and made friends with me. And he introduced me to them. We made friends rather rapidly. And there was a little white Russian salon in Washington kept by a woman called Mrs. Wiley, who was the wife of a State Department ex-ambassador. John Wiley, for the British Jewish sculptures. No use to meet. They took the lines, and there was the only man they'd ever met in their lives, would never been to Moscow, who never understood the situation as they understood it. Nobody else had known me to Moscow, culprits. By some intuitive genius, I entered into what the Soviet Union was like, in detail. Very good. So we were all very crazy again. And I was part of all that. And then Clark Carr, who was the British ambassador in Moscow, was rather a card.
What do you mean by that?
A card, adventurer, amusing, rather, I don't think he had much conscience, cavalierly type, extremely amusing, very clever, didn't mind what he did, not pompous, and manipulated people. And was obviously much more pro-Soviet than ambassador's any business to be.
Yes.
But a lot of sense of adventure and pleasure.
Mm.
No political views.
Yes.
Just thought it was all fun. Russians liked him very much.
Mm.
Stalin gave him two presents. He gave him a gun and gave him a masseur, German masseur, we asked for. He was not an homosexual. I can tell you a lot about him, but he's another story. Anyway, he came to Washington en route to San Francisco, to which he was summoned,
yes.
Part of the German entourage. And we had lunch together. For some reason he died about me, from the Americans. And so I was asked to lunch by, I can't remember who, I think the ambassador, Halifax, to meet him. I sat next to him, we chatted, and we got on, and he said, look, you speak, I'm told you speak Russian, like a native, in fact you are a native. He said, nobody in my embassy talks much Russian. Would you like to come, work for me for a bit? I said, I'd like nothing better. See if I can fix it. Then he went
Why
off.
Why did you say so immediately? I'd like.
Because I longed to go to Moscow, because I was curious.
Mm-hmm.
Pure curiosity drove me there, for no other reason.
It didn't awaken what it awakened in my father when he was first asked, a deep anxiety about being being in exile, being
No, none at all.
Oh God, I'll be kidnapped.
No, no, no. I thought if I went to an embassy, it'd be all right.
Oh.
You see, I thought, what if I went to a passport? Because by this time, we're 9:45.
Mm.
Yeah. And relations were presumably rather good.
Yeah.
We allies for years, you see.
That's it.
And we were on the edge of Germany being defeated. So, I mean, relations were ostensibly rather good. Wasn't very frightened. So then, he went to San Francisco, and I went to San Francisco too, in the end. And we met there again. He said he'd do it. And duly, I received a summons to be a temporary second secretary, first secretary. My rank in Moscow from roughly September onwards. For a limited period, if not specified.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 or 4 months, I mean, no idea. War was coming to an end, and I was anyhow not going to go on. It wasn't at all in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Then, that's how it happened. Then, on the, I can now tell you the way, on the way back from San Francisco, Mr. Boland traveled in an aeroplane with Halifax, same plane. And he told Halifax that I was the only person who really understood the American point of view on Russia and many other things, and that at Potsdam Conference I'd be invaluable as a link.
Mm-hmm. So Boland says to Halifax, you should go to Potsdam.
Yes. So Halifax said, when I came back to Washington, said, it's a jolly good idea, see what I can do. And then I suddenly received a summons from the Foreign Office saying, would I act as interpreter for Eden at Potsdam, if there's any way in which I could be got to Potsdam, except with alacrity. Then I had this frightful flu, and I was in bed, quite a high temperature, and I thought, no, shall I really go? I think I can quite. Doctors came and saw me. And then Halifax called my bedside and said, look, do go. If you did go to Potsdam, we'll never know what happens there. We'll never be told. Mm. You're awfully useful there, you know, as a spy for the British Embassy. I said, I saw what you meant.
Right.
Of course, and so I picked myself up and took enormous amount of antibiotics. I got myself into a plane and flew to London. And I was interviewed by the head of the American department and by a man called David Scott, who's still alive, and said this and that, where I was to go, I was to come back to the Foreign Office and be fitted out for certain documents the next day. So I appeared on the second day. I was living in the Ritz Hotel, I think, by this time. I came the second day, and David Scott was an awfully nice man. He said, I'm really sorry, I'm afraid I'm not going to Potsdam. I said, no. He said, well, you know, it's difficult to explain. Mrs. Gibbs was a later lady, sort of well-known receptionist of the British Embassy in Washington. She became Betty Harcourt. Says there's no logique. So I said, I'm terribly sorry to hear this. It's really, I'm very sorry to say this at the last moment. I said, you know, I don't know, no doubt what you were telling me is true. But if anyone asks you why you didn't go to Potsdam, it's very difficult to say there's no bed. You must give me a better story to tell.
Yeah.
He said, oh, well, I know what you mean. The Foreign Office is a very bad employer. But I'm afraid it's terrible. I'm afraid it's been decided. So then I said, well, I suppose I don't really mind very much. I go, very much, nothing more to say. He said, you say you don't mind. Tomorrow, you'll mind like hell, he said. This is rather sweet.
Yeah.
You'll mind frightfully. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
There's no question you're not minding. There's absolutely nothing I can tell you.
Yeah.
But I had no idea what was happening. And so, I remember going to tea in the Foreign Office that day and sitting next to, who did I sit next to, what's his name? Damn, I became Foreign Minister, the Prime Minister. He was trained with Prime
Minister
Hume.
Hume.
Who was in the Foreign Office for some reason.
Yeah.
Some sort of rank here.
Yeah.
And I told him about this and he said, yes, Foreign Office is a very odd organization. Take people, they drop people. They're ghastly, really. I don't like them much. And you won't like them after this. Then came Potsdam, then came the collapse of the Conservative government. Then everybody, the Foreign Office, only to please to tell them what happened. It was Eden who stopped it.
Yeah.
For no reason at all. Just took against me
yeah.
in some way. Didn't like me. And he said, no, no, I don't think Stalin likes Latvians. Some such thing as that. Mm. Can't have Latvian. I think it'll go very badly. He just simply, I did it's purely personal, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I didn't get to Potsdam. And I remember complaining to various people who knew him. And they kept on bringing it up to him. He got into a state of absolute fury. He thought he'd never hear about this again. He kept on socially hearing about it. From various ladies with whom he knew. These dons think they can do anything. These dons think he's getting above themselves, you know. I'm good to know that. When we next met, he was extremely polite, not to say secrets,
yeah.
Eden. But that's why I never went to Potsdam.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think.
How disappointed were you?
Bitterly.
Yes.
I long to go.
Because it really was.
Then I wrote to Clark R. saying, if the Foreign Office doesn't want to go to Potsdam, perhaps I'm altogether untrustworthy. I better not come to Moscow either.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote back saying, don't be a bloody fool. The plane goes on September the 4th or something.
Yes.
So I flew to Moscow via Berlin, which was a lunar spectacle.
Okay.
Nothing was recognizable.
You landed in Tempelhof, sort of?
Somewhere. I don't know where we landed. In 45. September, early September, 45.
Nothing standing. Did you go into the city at all or just change from?
Well, I walked about it, no, not very much. There's nothing, you couldn't walk along the streets. There was a paving blocks were ruined. I mean, Germans were running about like frightened rabbits. I mean, sort of looking humble and frightened. And the waiters in the hotel, if you put up a, I mean, we trembled before everybody and wrote things and shivered. I've never seen such a terrified lot of people. Then I met President Lord Annan, my old friend Goran Veris, another character that was in British intelligence.
Yes.
Because there was a kind of British canteen.
Yes.
Which we all hit.
Was that your first encounter with Noel?
I think so. Yeah. I think I knew him for a while. He thinks we did meet. But I have no recollection of it.
We are in Berlin and it's a...
We're in Berlin. It's a lunar spectacle. The Germans are terrified clowns running about in this. People with sort of things in their backs and off dressed and carrying parcels.
Did that give you a certain gratification?
Yes. I didn't feel the least sympathetic. Not the least. I think I'd known that Noel before I married him. Anyway, then I came with a man called Ashton Gottkin, who was a man who was on the Runciman mission to Prague in 1900 and presumably 38, mm-hmm. out of which came Munich.
Yeah.
In the end, Foreign Office official, who wrote novels under an assumed name. This is a rather sort of snobbish official, not much trusted, never got a knighthood, straight into his soul. He was an inspector. The Foreign Office to inspect the embassy, see if it could save some money by sacking the people. And yeah, we flew together. It's very agreeable man to talk to. Rather bohemian character. We arrived in Moscow, were duly met by some second secretary, I think, taken to the embassy. I was planted in a house, the Skansitny Periolok. Turning of Ulitsa Varovskoye. Varovsky, remember, was a Soviet ambassador assassinated in Lausanne fairly soon after the war by some Swiss White Russian literary figure, writer, Varovsky, Jew, I think. And there are my companions, were a man called Sapunsen Mimar Crosthwaite, was at college with me, at Corpus, with a great, great friend, and a man called Eddie Tompkins, who was a straight Foreign Office official, later became ambassador in Paris.
Yeah.
Both of whom I still know and love. We lived in a flat, in a house which had belonged to the Italian military mission for the war. And below us lived the head of the minister, who was Roberts, and underneath somebody else.
What impression did the city of Moscow make when you first arrived?
Well, I'm not very visual, you know. Yet I'd never seen it before. It was wartime. It had a wartime air.
What does wartime air mean?
It hadn't been bombed. There were no destroyed buildings that I could see. The streets were dirty. The inhabitants wore very poor, extremely rags, to some extent. Shops contained no goods. The only shops of interest were the second-hand bookshops, the antiquari, where you could pick up things, particularly then. Because
yeah.
Some people died during the war and the books found their way
to
these shops. The Bolshoi was booming. Particularly for benefit of foreigners, but anyway, theatres were functioning to the full, and the ambassador was Clark Carr, as I told you, who was a favourite of the Russians, no doubt about that. He's called Partisan by the Russians because they said Molotov said to him, you're a fine type, you could have been a partisan. And they were all drunk. The Kremlin that night, and he pushed him in the chest, Molotov, which he didn't do to many people, and he collapsed into a huge fish bowl containing a huge fish salad, and it was fished out and dried. And the Japanese ambassador sent a cable, which was intercepted, which said, the Prime Minister of the Soviet Union knocked down the British ambassador and trampled upon him. Gave a rather false impression. Japanese, what does that mean? That telegram was intercepted.
Yes.
Trampled upon him.
But rather surprisingly, you're not conveying an impression of a country staggering to its feet after the war. You're conveying the impression of a capital that, for the party brass, is actually quite bearable.
It was. By 45, everything had been restored. I mean, I think it was restored after 44. Once Soviet troops began to fight abroad, the whole bureaucracy, everything was more or less restored. And I think you would find that if you look at the memoirs of people too at that time, you didn't get the impression of a devastated city in any way. Not like London. You see, I don't think it was ever shelled. I don't think it was bombed much. And it was never taken. And so, well, there must have been quite a lot of destruction. But slave labor restores things rather fast. I'm trying to remember what happened. On the third day, I wanted to know where my father's relation lived. Mm-hmm. He had three brothers and a sister that I knew, because my father had been there on business in 34 or 35, a timber merchant. So I went to one of those little kiosks and gave out addresses on payment of 2 rubles. There's no telephone book.
Yes.
Because that had been destroyed. Yes. And anyhow, because of Germans, there were no telephone years. No public document giving addresses.
Yes.
Now, we paid them rubles and they looked up things in some document they had. And they told me to give them the name. So I said, Dr. Professor Berlin. I said, I did it. Professor Lev Borisovich Berlin. But they didn't give it to me at once. They said, come back in 2 hours. It's clear that I was followed by some sinister figure, which made it clear that I couldn't be served in the ordinary way.
Yes.
I did come back, perhaps unwisely, in about 2 hours, and then they gave me. My father had it. I simply didn't bother to ask him. It's foolish. I came back with a little fiche containing their names and addresses in my pocket. Next day, I had an attack of flu, so I didn't get up for 2 days. When I got up, everything was there, except a little bit of paper. That had gone. Unwise, I mean, they could have Xeroxed and photographed it. The fact they took it away, I didn't know what that meant.
Yes.
However, I remembered it. So I thought, well, they've got it, yes. The cook, everybody was served. Served us with
KGB.
Yeah, absolutely. NKVD. Was in those days, I think. That's clear. Including the chauffeur, the car. So I thought, well, they know what I'm doing. They never got the address. What would be wiser? To go or not to go?
Yes.
I thought, well, if they know that I've got it, to go back. Why, unwise not to go, because then they think,
yes.
I saw them some other way, it'd be, I don't know, maybe it's better to behave naively.
Yes.
In such case. And I didn't do anything for a while. The woman who brought me my cup of tea in the morning, who was a cook, said, they say that Stalin is very ill. I said, oh, I haven't heard that. American ambassador called on him at Sochi quite a short time ago. He found him in perfectly good health. Oh, it's great, great. It's only good people who fall ill. Then she said, have you ever heard the name Trotsky? I said, yes, I have. He was a good man, wasn't he? I said, no, I don't think he was a particularly good man. Oh, yeah, he was a good man. No, no, I said, no. No, I have no reason for thinking that. We don't think he was a good man. I said, no, this is a sort of crude provocation of some kind. You see, I realized what was happening. Mm-hmm. And you see, then she went away. And that was on the third day, fourth day. Then on the fifth day or so, maybe a little later, I thought I'd go and see these people, my relations. I thought I wouldn't go to direct like that. No, wait. I'm getting chronology wrong. I kept the address, I wrote it down here, somewhere, my notebook. The next thing which happened was a dinner given by the British Ally, which was a periodical, legally produced by the British Embassy, of a propagandist nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In honor of your existence for 5 years, I think. And Russian writers were invited. Priestley was there. Priestley at that point was a very favorite figure in the Soviet Union because he said Russian Soviet literature is the conscience of the world. Two of his plays were ever put on. I went to the dinner. That I do describe in the piece you haven't derived. In a very bad temper, because he couldn't get rubles out of the country and because it let down a lot of kolkhozes you didn't want to see. I mean, he was in very, and Speaker Anya, he was. So he was led up to a man called Chukovsky, who was a marvelous writer of children's verse and a great literary historian and critic. He said, "You're some kind of translator, aren't you?" He was very offended. And then I was wheeled up to make it better. I made friends with him. It was very nice. I made him. Then I sat next to a man called Tairov, who was a producer, famous Moscow art theater. Chatted to him. He said, "You know, you are British Embassy." I said, "Yes." "Not only do you speak Russian perfectly, but the order of your thoughts is Russian. Chod mysli. Chod mysli. Chod mysli." Very interesting.
You must have felt wonderful.
Yes. Yes. He was liquidated about 2 years later. Very well, you know what for, but he was. 47, 48. Very nice man. I talked very freely to these people. Pasternak was not there. And there I met Prokofiev's widow, who just died in Paris.
Yes.
She was half Catalan,
yes,
half Polish.
By that time they were long separated anyway.
So yes. Mm-hmm. Not long, there was a... She was a very unsuitable person. They put on a communist lady onto him to make him write patriotic pieces. It was their doing, really.
Yes.
And I'd been mentioned Pasternak, and she said, "Oh, I know him quite well." I said, "I've got a pair of boots from his sisters for him." Mm-hmm. She said, "Well, we'll go and see him together." Mm-hmm. And she took me.
Now, tell me how you knew about Pasternak.
Because of the two sisters. Mm-hmm. I knew the name.
Yes, because of the two sisters.
There were two sisters in Oxford.
Yes.
When I said I was going to Moscow, she asked me to take me these boots to him. Which I took with me.
Were you admired already?
I mean, oh, yes, yes, yes.
Now, what had you read?
3 or 4 poems.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing very much.
But none of the short fiction or none
no,
of
no, 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 no. Didn't know it existed.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a student of Soviet literature at all. Then I went to Peredelkino. That was my stop.
Yes.